Session number 30423, reel 10.
Afghanistan. Two things. One, no outside country, military or political, has ever defeated Afghan or controlled Afghanistan. History would right back through history. So many battles, so many powers to be, and it's still the same today. Even mighty Russia. Russia was mighty. Except he didn't use his atomic bomb. And that was what destroyed everything. Even they lost. No one will win Afghanistan military-wise. Now, they have to push that, which is the dominant population, really. You have a situation which is out of control, the opium trade. There's all like fighting villages and learning, teaching them how hygiene, how to grow crops, irrigation. The poppy field is gold dust to them. That's what they want. And we do nothing about it. Until that is looked at, it's like my theory about the lifeblood of traffickers in the cash flow. It is the cash flow that counts in Afghanistan. There are warlords. There are those who are only interested in the material side of life, the cash. So we are fighting a brave battle, but one we cannot win. Politically or militarily. And who is going to be brave enough to wipe out all the poppy fields? There are several, it's like a chessboard, pawns and knights and queens and kings. My Joe, I've really let rip on that one. Sorry.
To what degree was it possible to judge the effectiveness of the 12th Indian Division, the 20th Indian Division in Saigon, in its efforts to suppress or control the Vietnam?
First class. Absolutely. Now, again, it involved my being with them. And I'm not talking as a biased person protecting my own interest or my own history or work. The 20th Indian Division went in as a control commission. They went in and they cleaned out all the nests of Japanese, those that might have wanted to go on, those that were trying to be political. They clamped down on everything. The administration that was put on was first class. The transportation system, first class. Unfortunately, the uprising changed the role of the South Indian Division, changed it completely into being a fighting division as well as a control commission. So, as a control commission, they were successful, very successful, accepted and efficiently working. As a fighting machine, there could be no winners. They were simply trying to bring back law and order by whatever means that could be achieved legally. And that is a very hard job for a commanding officer. And Major General D.D. Gracie, in my opinion, was a brilliant strategist. He did as he saw it on the ground, not looking at the political ultimate end or what his superiors back in Kandy, Mount Siak, would think. He did it as he saw it on the ground. And I think 20th Division, the 20th Division, would deserve any praise or any award that could ever be given. And I mean that. But no one at the end of the day in power politics or military strategy look at what has really been achieved. They look at, does it affect our aims? Does it affect the big picture? But you wouldn't get a big picture unless you looked after the little ones. So I have great... No, I'm not an army man. I'm not really a soldier or a professional sailor. I was just an ordinary person doing an ordinary job and looking at it through the eyes of the truth. What was the truth? What really happened? Why was it done that way? We handed over to Leclerc and his second DB a first-class situation. What they did with it afterwards, not our concern. So we can say it was a success.
How much at the time did you feel that there was a clear strategy?
At the time, no. No. At the time, I only knew what I was doing. What was going to happen today or tomorrow, not next week, or not what Tracy was doing. At the time, I only lived for the day. It is only as things developed. Once I was there, I began to understand what we're trying to achieve. Now, I would never have never gone out on a patrol on my days off from the border station with the army patrols in the Gurkhas to wipe out the village just for the hell of it or because somebody thought it was a good idea. I knew why we were going to do it. And I voluntarily went along. I was like a bit of a loose cannon, I suppose. I mean, my job was at the railway station, but I kept involved in other things. Now, that was my own initiative, I suppose. But then, when you have a situation with a limited amount of people, everyone does move in to help. And I could say, it needs help. I'll go. Unless I believed it was correct, I would not have gone. I think I had some moral responsibility to my own beliefs, probably even more powerful. I wasn't going to stick myself and get killed if I could help it. So I must have done it because I thought it was the right thing to do. But to know what was happening, no. I don't think 99% of us in the war knew the big picture. We know it now, and with hindsight, we're quite clever. I'm talking now as if I knew it all. It's only because of hindsight and study, reading, listening, hearing other people's views, 60 odd years later. So it's taken 60 years of experience to find out what I believed happened in 6 months.
What was your attitude towards the Viet Minh, the Ammonites themselves?
There was no sympathy because I did not really know their aims. The Ammonites, at that time, in that day, were rebels who were opposing authority and causing loss of life, loss of property and damage, and they were to be stopped. And simply that. They were there to be, if you're going to kill someone, they're going to kill you. Sadly, you're going to kill them. But I think that never occurred to us. We didn't go and kill people. The only time we ever got involved in anything was somebody attacked us. We were never an aggressive body. We were a control commission. It must not be misunderstood. At no time were we thought we were fighting, that we were doing something other than what we were trying to control. And to be a control commission, you've got to look at the basics. We must stop damage, stop fighting, stop people being killed.
And what now is your view about the Second World War as a whole?
Again, I'm talking of 60 odd years later with hindsight. So at the time, none of my present thoughts would have existed or be outspoken. We failed miserably in the 30s when Germany was rearming, when it was fairly obvious they were going away from the treaties. The glider pilots were being trained. Well, glider pilots were harmless, but of course they become fighter pilots or bomber pilots. All this was known, but the blind eye was being shut. People looked at the good things happening in Germany, the auto plans, the efficiency. Look at this, he's creating employment. It's a very good country. We ought to be allied to the Germany, you know. Others are saying, look, they're a danger for the future. But so nothing was done. There's a conflict of opinions. Churchill, who I admire greatly, was sometimes terribly wrong, terribly off-beam, but he created an image and an atmosphere and a confidence of the people to keep going. If you'd have had someone like Chamberlain who wanted peace, or Halifax, Lord Halifax, he would have quite happily, I think, joined in with the German regime. Yes, we'd have become part of the German nation. And a lot of people, I think, would have been quite happy with that. But Churchill stopped all that by his clever speeches. Never so much so to so many by so few, or we will fight on the beaches, blood, sweat and tears, all good stuff. I don't think it will work today. I don't think it will be swallowed. But in those days, it was good stuff. Gave people the backbone. Yes, we will fight on. Business as usual. The Hun. So we had a war. They were brilliant generals. There were some disastrous generals. I thought Wellesley was a bit hard done by. I thought Montgomery was a bit egotistical. But these are a layman's view, not a professional view. Our mistake was at Yalta, where we let Stalin really pull our strings. Roosevelt was so ill. Churchill didn't want to go along, but you can't fight both. And I think we allowed the Cold War to slip in there. But on the other hand, you've got to look at it another way. Russia lost more people, civilians and military, than any of other countries in the Allies. Their country was devastated. They had a lot to fight for, a lot to get back, a lot to be bitter about. So depends on the viewpoint, the picture you're looking at. You can argue at one and agree with one. But the war itself, I think, now, this may seem strange to say to you, I believe there was divine intervention. Dunkirk was remarkable saving of military personnel and some equipment, and it could have been disaster, could have finished us. The Battle of Britain, we should have lost. They had so much expertise in flying, bombing, fighting. A few beat them. We had to turn around at Suez in North Africa. And all these things were out of the blue. Nobody could have planned them. They happened. I think civilization was saved because we'd have gone back to the Dark Ages with Germany and with Japanese in control of the world, or even perhaps Russia. So I think there was a pattern that is above our human understanding. Hence my word, divine intervention. Never heard anyone say that before. No, don't answer me. Don't do that. I'm not doing the questioning.
How long did you stay in the Merchant Navy for?
I went into the college in 1946. That would have been the same year as I came back from the war. I stayed in, and that was interesting. To get a ship was not easy. Shall I mention this to you now? I went to Lamport. I wrote to various shipping companies to try to get a post. Only one replied, Lamport and Holt. I went to see the staff manager. I had a chat with him. And we had an immediate rapport. His son had been lost at sea. And I think he saw, here's someone from the sea who survived. And he said, well, yes, I will find you a post. But you'll have to work for Marconi firm, who then have a franchise to give radio officers to shipping companies. And he raised it. So I went with Cunard as a fourth radio officer on the Franconia, a troop ship. And our first role was to go to Haifa and bring out the 6th Airborne Division. We were in Haifa, right inside, with fighting going on in the streets, machine gunning, fighting. I saw the Jewish ships that had been sunk in the harbour, refugees. Brought the 6th Airborne Division out, went to India, brought out civilians and military after the partition there. So that was very interesting to go back over the ground that I'd been before, Aden, Bombay. Very interesting, but in a different role. I came back. I was then experienced with the Merchant Navy. They had a post vacant. It was for a chief radio officer on their Commodore ship, the Defo, in Newport Note, trading the South American route. And I became into that post, very, very senior post in the company. And, of course, I think I had some background, I'd had experience, which was probably not existing by people who had just come from civilian life to become Merchant Navy. I had something a bit extra. I would hope that was the fact. And we traded Rio de Janeiro, Montevideo, Buenos Aires, up the Rio Plata, up to Rosario, until Peron fell out with this country on the meat trade, fruit meat pack. And even down there was interesting, particularly in Argentina with their very Germanic military and police and corruption. In Rosario, I was appointed the mediator between the dock workers and the shipping company, bribing the docks to unload our ship for coils of rope or paint or cigarettes. I find that quite interesting. Or to go ashore in Buenos Aires and be stopped by the police at gunpoint, and then produce from under your coat a stack of Lucky Strikes, cigarettes, to be let go. So we saw a regime there which wasn't far off a Germanic idea. Anyway, that fell through. So we sailed from there with minimal sand ballast down through Magellan Straits and out into the Pacific into the most horrendous storm I've ever seen. Beat the one off of South Africa. I was on the deck watching the pointer swinging to and fro with the first mate, thinking, I don't think it'll come back for a storm. Oh, yes, it will. And we had the most horrific journey because the storm was violent, but we had no cargo on board, minimal sand ballast. Anyway, we got across the Pacific, we traded Tasmania, Australia, back up the Suez to Genoa. My duties on board was interesting. I was a radio officer. I helped with navigation. I was always interested in maps, and I helped with that. And when we were in port and close to the radio station, I worked as a deck officer, supervising the loading, unloading, and control. Again, rather like the atmosphere of the band. It was a Commodore ship, but limited in staff, very close, very happy, all working together. A wonderful team. Wonderful team. And our passengers were 24 only first class. And each officer took a table, about four each. So the six officers had a table each. So our living was very nice. The work was interesting. But coming home through the Mediterranean, we were off Crete. And we broke down. And I received a cable. Son John Bourne. 10th of October. 4th of October. And we'd been married then since 47. It's now in the August of 49. And I worked out, I will get home twice a year. The next 20 years, I'd probably be worth 40 times, and I gave a great deal of thought what I should do. We went into Antwerp with orders to return to the route again through Australia, but it was changed at the last minute. We went to Glasgow. We went on leave, and I went to the library building in Liverpool, saw the staff officer, and handed him my resignation. Quite correctly, quite gentlemanly, accepted it. Came home. I joined the police force as a constable. Little story there if you're interested. I came home from the war a great deal of loss of weight. I was only about 9 stone. I now got about 10 stone. And I wasn't very tall, I was 5'10". Devon Constabulary were taking men at least 5'10", 6 foot. The local Sergeant Newton, said to me, look, if I were you, I'd go up on the den by the pier. There's a chap up there, Coast Guard, who in his spare time weighs and measures the holiday makers for them. Go up and see him. So I went up, I got the message. I came back. I was a good 11 and a half stone and 5'11". And handed it to him, and I then was told to report to headquarters with a friend of Michael Jack Shepherd, who'd been a Fleet Air Arm pilot, who brought me back. He kept that quiet. We went to see Colonel Bacon, commonly known to the troops as Rasher Bacon, fine figure of a man, and a marvellous chief constable. Looked at me and said, Stars, do you think you'll grow? Because he'd realised that wasn't happened. But I was wearing my naval uniform. Because I only had a demob suit, and that was going to be a bit threadbare. And so I joined. Some years later, I was commandant of the police training college and responsible for recruiting of Devon and Cornwall. And a chap came in. I'd interview them all first before they took their test, just to weed out those we wouldn't really want. And we've been very selective then in those days. Chaps that I'm called Newton, where he lived, Teamworth. Is your father by any chance Sergeant Newton? Oh, yes, it is. I said, thank you very much. He joined the police force. I thought, well, I've returned the compliment. Now, that's a little anecdote, but it's not for publication. Anyway, I went on. I served as 18 years in CID on the amalgamation with Plymouth and Cornwall. I took over the CID in Plymouth, and the special squads formed a full squad which would operate throughout the Southwest, specialised officers, a murder squad, the first type of squad they'd had. Then one day, the new chief constable, Lieutenant Colonel Greenwood, sent for me, and he said, Stowers, you're superintendent in Plymouth City. All this land around headquarters was a market garden. We own that. It's been my dream to have a peace college of a certain type. We have 200 cadets. Now we're going to build the college. And I said, look, sir, I have the faintest idea about training or about what you should have. He said, no, that's why I'm asking you. I don't want anyone with preconceived ideas. I'll give you 12 months. Study the problem. Go where you like. I went to France. Looked at the staff college in Lyon. Good vineyard in the Rhone area. Now, I studied it properly. Went to all the various places I could. Questioning. Cut a long story short, the college was built. We not only recruited for Devon and Cornwall, but we did not train them. They went to Dorset, to a place called Chartmel. I said the college would be specialised. We would do fraud. We would do drugs. We would do riot control. All the subjects that no one else was touching. And advertise it to all the other forces. And they would pay to send their men. It was a gamble, and it paid off, hands down. It paid for everything we did. The Royal Marine Commando Centre is at Limestone. I said, I've designed a swimming pool with a specially deep end for sub-aqua training. That's what your people want. Oh, yes, we haven't got that. Will you then train our men in sniper drill, firearms? The president, the chief constable at that time, first class, I had some good chicos. He said, Stars, I don't like what you're doing. I don't agree with your riot training or your arm training. I said, sir, one day it will be needed. You'll have problems. If you don't have the people trained, you'll have problems. Okay, do it. Then we were using a range near a hospital, and a newspaper published a story that we were shooting and disturbing the nurses, etc. The reply was, we're delighted to know this is happening. Please do not stop it, because one day it might be necessary. That was, whoever wrote that letter was inspired, because it allowed me to go. Well, I brought over the Drugs Enforcement Agency training team from America. They have never taught in this country. The Home Office said, I don't think you can do this. I'll reply, we are not a Home Office Police College. We're Devon and Cornwall. We're inviting this team over. They sent down observers, and they came from the Army and the Air Force and the Home Office. It was such a success. They were taken over by the Metropolitan Police and asked to go there and work as well. So all these little things. I then started taking overseas senior officers from various countries.